The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.
Stepping into our interview this morning here on Freedom 106.5 FM, I'd like to welcome Mr. Nikolai Edwards. He is the political leader of the Progressive Party, and our discussion this morning will be the Salaries Review Commission and the conversation about increasing salaries for representatives across the board and the reaction of many quarters. So we'd like to hear what his stance is on the subject. So welcome to Freedom 106.5. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So first tell us a little bit about yourself and how you decided to get into the political sphere, as tenuous and competitive as it is. What made you decide to join?
Sure. So I, for one, I believe Freedom listeners would know a bit about me. I used to help to hold down the afternoon shift there when Freedom just came onto the airways, moving from Akash Vani. I have had a love for media for several years. I started off my career in media at another media house on radio, moved over to television and had a really good career there. One of the things that I developed over the years, or felt that I had a sense of or a command of, was the ability to relay issues, seek out solutions, to be a representative voice. That is something that during my time at the University of the West Indies, I really put on display, so to say, because I was a member of the Guild of Students and so on. So that naturally led to me being involved in other causes, other roles, representational roles, and so on. So I was able to serve on the Commonwealth Youth Council. And from there, the president of Trinidad and Tobago, he would have given me the opportunity to serve as an independent senator. And this was President Anthony Kamona. So I truly had an opportunity there to move the youth voice into parliament. And that would have been in 2017. The first piece of legislation that I had the honor and the privilege of debating had to do with the Marriages Act and bringing an end to child marriages in Trinidad and Tobago, something I'm very proud of. I got a taste of representational politics insofar as representing in the Senate young people. And from there, when President Kamona left office, there was not really a pathway for me to get back into the Senate and so on. So that's how I decided that I was going to start a political party, which I did in 2019, the Progressive Party. And I contested the San Fernando West seat under my party in 2020. So that's a bit of my foray into politics, moving from media. And I'm just the kind of person who believes in Trinidad and Tobago. I, despite all the things that are being said, despite the high crime rate, the murders, all of these things, you really have to have some hope. That's the only way. And of course, put in the work. And that's the only way we can move Trinidad and Tobago forward. So I'm here as a citizen who honestly cares about his country. And I felt it important to add my voice to this discussion because it's been really clouded in politics and emotions and so on. And I just really want us as a country to be practical about what we're seeing, what we're thinking, and what we're doing.
Now, the Salaries Review Commission has written this 120th report and suggesting that those who are in positions to represent us, they are worthy of such an increase. First of all, do you think that that is proper reasoning? Is it something that should be considered as appropriate? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that can be held off on? What's your positioning on that?
Mm-hmm. No, my position is very clear. You pay people an honest pay for an honest day's work. Mm-hmm. This is all that it is. It has nothing to do with Dr. Keith Rowley, Mrs. Kamala Prasad Bisesa, or any of the named MPs of Parliament. This has to do with the offices that they hold. And of course, we know that they're not going to be there forever. So we can't make our decisions and pass judgment based on the current office holders. And I want to make that very clear. So when we think about the office of the Prime Minister, for instance, this is one of the most, well, if not the most powerful position in the country. Here you have whomsoever that office holder is responsible for 1.4 million people. Yet we have in the private sector and even in the public sector through some of those public companies and so on, where you have CEOs who would be responsible for a much smaller workforce making in excess of $100,000 per month.
Mm-hmm.
We have the CEO of WASA making $100,000, the CEO of Heritage making, I believe it's $185,000 or $165,000 per month. And I mean, some of us wish we could even make that in a year. But this is the reality that the market allows for. If you want people to hold positions of authority and decision-making and whom the buck will stop at the end of the day, then you have to really create the conditions for them to be able to execute their job well and for them to be compensated properly. It's just like the teachers, the TNTech workers, the port workers. Everyone wants to get their salary at updated levels because we would have experienced increasing inflation. We know the challenges that exist. And that's why you're seeing the environment as tense and as hot as it is right now, where protests are abound and so on. So we can't expect that at the lower levels, we are seeing where people are demonstrating for fair pay. And we can't think that that is only for those lower levels. As much as we may have a bad taste in our mouth when it comes to politicians and so on, we have to be able to separate the office from the office holder. And the office, I think, has a certain level of reverence, and we must be able to treat with that as it as we ought to.
So the positioning of many across certain sectors have said the timing seems to be a bit of an issue. And not only that, the cost, the entire cost of it is $150 million, seeing as the... We rightly started off by saying we need to separate the person from the office itself. And obviously, if there has not been a reasonable increase from, I believe it was 2015, they said, to now, then it stands to reason if everyone else is asking for an increase, why not the office holders? But the timings has, as you said, rubbed a different kind of taste in people's mouths. And not only that, the amount of money that is going to be spent, especially if it is that you're telling those who are asking or who have negotiated a percentage that is even smaller than what is proposed for these office holders, you could see why people are upset. What is your positioning or comment on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, the timing will never be right. Let's get that clear. We've been at this junction before as a country. I want to remind citizens that this report and these increases, they're not new. It was only in February of this year that the 117th report of the SRC would have come to the Parliament. And when it came to the Parliament, the Minister of Finance, he would have sent it back to the SRC for them to make some adjustments because there were some inconsistencies in the report and so on. But if the average citizen actually takes the time and reads the report, what you would garner from it is that a job evaluation exercise would have taken place in this country over several years. It was initiated back in 2009, and you had a cabinet then approving or giving permission for the SRC to proceed with this exercise. They would have hired a consultant and so on. And we, of course, had things such as COVID-19 happening and so many things. You had to literally go through the job description of every single public servant under the remit of the Salaries Review Commission. And what they sought to do was to streamline their approach to compensating people in who fall within the public service under their remit. So now the SRC has advanced updated job descriptions, and now the job descriptions, they are asking that the compensation be in line with that. So they would have looked at the private sector, they would have looked at the market, at comparable jobs, and they would have felt cases the salary of many office holders was below what the market would allow for. All right. So this is a report that is not biased. And I want people to understand that it isn't about just government officials. It isn't about just the politicians. We have within that the chief medical officer. We have the DPP. We have the chief fire officer. We have so many other positions, whether at the local government level, come straight up. Mm-hmm. So it's really bringing, and also what people need to understand, because it's a 93.3% of the officers who are expected, once this is approved, they are expected to get a salary increase. 4.5% of the officers in receipt will be in receipt of a decrease. So there are actually persons or offices where the salary is a bit higher than it is supposed to be. So the SRC recommended.
I'm glad that you're actually detailing what is inside of the SRC's report, because I think that that more than anything needs to be clarified as to, one, what the report really says, two, how they came to that information. And you also described something that I spoke about as well, understanding the job descriptions of these positions, because it has been noticed over the COVID period, for whatever reason, if it is to reduce workforce, to keep safety standards and health standards at a certain level, many of the responsibilities were kind of meshed into one. So a lot of people were like doing double the work for the same pay over that time period. So an adjustment was needed. The ambiguous part of the SRC's report for the public are those finer points. Where did this information come from? Where did the comparison come from? And what resources does the public have to actually research these things?
Sure. Well, the SRC, the Salaries Review Commission, it has a constitutional responsibility and a constitutional mandate to engage on these salary reviews periodically. Mm-hmm. So think about it like this. The Constitution provides that a body be set up, and it is expected to be a fair, objective, non-biased body. And their job is to review the salaries within the country so that it's not a case where a minister is just jumping up and deciding to introduce legislation and ascribe whatever salary he or she wants to a special purposes company board or whatever it is. We have provisions within the law that speaks to a process. So you would see, whether it's on a yearly basis or ever so often, that many times the salary review, the SRC would be engaging in these kinds of reviews. And it's not to say that every year they're reviewing the salaries of government officials and public officials in the way that they have undertaken this particular exercise. Remember, this is one that is now tied to updated job descriptions. So once we actually pass this, and I know that people are very much concerned with the idea. Now, I'm just going to say, of course, if people want to read the report, it has in it the named consultant, the process that was undertaken. There was a process where the judiciary would have been heavily involved. The judiciary did not like the approach that the consultant was taking and made some suggestions. The SRC took that back and implemented it. So it was a very lengthy process. We're talking something that started since 2009, all right? And people are talking about the timing. This thing came out in February. It was sent back, and it came back to the government because there's a deadline in which it has to be sent back. So all of these things, provisions are made for. People are not taking on this in an ad hoc manner. So when we think now about the large increase, or it's $150 million for this exercise. Of course, there are quite a good number of offices that are going to benefit from this. We're focusing too much on just the salary of the prime minister, the president, the opposition leader, and so on. But there are many persons, and people have to think about it in the context of, if you want to make it personal, your mother might be working in one of these ministries as the head of a department, or as deputy,
or a secretary,
somewhere.
Or something.
Don't you want, whatever it may be, wouldn't you want her to get paid the salary that she deserves? Mm-hmm. And we are also thinking about it as being this huge jump. Salaries have not been adjusted for these offices for quite some time. And what people fail to understand is that if the government decides not to implement this now because of public pressure, because of bending to the politics that is at play at the moment, it will have to be dealt with by another administration, because you can't continue to just leave this be, and people will get an even larger back pay or payout. Mm-hmm. So whether we do it now or we do it 5 years from now, there are going to be implications, financial implications. And one of the things that we have an issue with is that when it comes to paying out large back pay and so on, the government usually goes and borrows money. And when the government borrows the money, whether it's $1 billion or homsoever, don't we have to pay interest on that?
We have to pay it back.
So therefore, we are going to... Yeah, so as a population, as a taxpayer, it is going to affect us in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Let's look for the softest landing, and also let's treat people with the respect and reverence that they deserve. If they have taken it upon themselves to educate themselves, to put themselves in line to be in a position, when they get to that position, the last thing they should be worried about is being compensated properly. Mm-hmm. They should have all the tools and resources available to them to execute their job and do that within, let's say, an environment that allows for mental and emotional stability. Mm-hmm. If you are thinking about long hours and you're burnt out and then you're not getting paid properly, that can have some issues and challenges for employers. And I'll just give you this example that many of us know all too well. Corruption happens from the smallest man go straight up. And when you have persons who may be working in a job, let's say they're making $5,000 or so, but really and truly, they should be making more like $8,000. It's difficult for them to get a job for whatever reason, because the market doesn't have many jobs, whatever it is. So you're stuck in this job. You are going to start to feel a sense of they owe you something. You're going to feel pressured to look at different forms of income and so on. You might be taking the stationery in the office and saying you honestly don't care because it's my money jumping up here. And you're taking the stationery, using it for your child's school projects and so on. And you have no regret or no remorse. And of course, these things start to manifest in different ways. You might have licensing officers who may feel that the only way that they are going to get their just dues is to engage in corrupt practices. And that's not right. And we can't start to talk about having a moral high ground and so on, because really and truly, that's not something we push too well in this country. So if we want to fix the issues, if we want people to walk the straight and narrow path, let's incentivize them. Let's let them be able to get into jobs and positions where they are treated and compensated fairly, so that they would not have to think about doing things on the side and cutting. So it's very simple. It's simple math. It's simple, a simple reasoned understanding as to why people deserve to be paid properly. It has nothing to do with politicians wanting to beef up their pockets. And let me just jump one other point to it.
Sure. Go ahead.
So the other thing in terms of politicians, because if I know a lot of the attention is on the politicians aspect of it and so on. We have a problem in this country where it is very much out of reach, it seems, for the average citizen to get into politics, into representational politics, because you have to either be so connected and so in cahoots with a political party that you're given the opportunity or the chance, or you have to be well off, extremely well off, because to fund an election campaign and so on, it's not an easy task. Mm-hmm. And then when you get into the office, the kind of work that comes along with that responsibility is far different from that as if you're in the private sector and so on. I make all of these points to lay the foundation for the idea that if we were to have people see pathways to getting into particular jobs and so on that are not jumping through hoops and all of these things, the condition for work as a government official or so on, if there was an easier pathway, I think that we would have been able to have people with better reputations, better backgrounds, who have the
Well,
only
I would
agenda
think
of
from the interaction that you've had so far within the political arena, you understand that, as you said, it's a very gated or closed, close-knit kind of, I don't want to say organization, but sector. Well, as you said, it's not very easy to enter. And the comments that I've been getting over the past couple of weeks from callers is that it seems that those who are not as involved in politics seem to have more of the solutions, and those who are in that position not really either connecting or hearing these solutions and find it very difficult to put into motion the solutions that can obviously help a situation. What do you think about that, one? And two, you made some very interesting points about understanding the job descriptions and also the rubric for understanding the SRC's positioning of increasing salaries in other positions that we may not be aware of. You mentioned secretaries and so on. Is there an SRC report specifically for the public servants, the ones who are in a quandary right now trying to figure out, well, if they're getting this percentage, why only 2% for us? Why only 4%? Is it possible for that kind of information pertaining to the public servants be more of a tool for their bargaining process rather than a place of drama and bacchanal? Because putting out these kinds of figures is what incites that kind of emotion from those who are, you know, struggling at the moment, trying to even get a 2% increase.
Sure. So what we have to understand when it comes to our labor market, how things operate and how things function. And mind you, it's not that I am a specialist on things relating to the SRC or anything of that sort. I'm just a citizen like everyone else, but one who takes the time to go through the documents, understand what I'm dealing with before I go out and I speak. And I mean, that's the approach that anyone should take.
That is the correct approach, correct.
So when it comes to those wider representing unions that will represent all of the teachers, you have the oil field workers trade union and so on, there are bargaining agreements in place. All right. Well, what I would say is that because I studied mediation, that I have a background in alternative dispute resolution, that's negotiation, conciliation, arbitration, things of that sort, it really allowed me to approach this thing with different eyes. So we have a chief personnel officer, and what tends to happen is that unions will enter negotiations with the chief personnel officer. The CPO negotiates on behalf of the government. So at the CPO's office, there will be research assistants, there will be individuals, and of course, the office, like many others, are not fully staffed. They have challenges and so on. So that's why you find it takes some time before or with negotiations, because the office now has to do that research over a particular period of time while also doing that for other in other negotiations.
Right.
So when they engage with the CPO will be able to say, well, this is the environment, this is what the market will offer and so on. But the CPO still has to rely on the government, because there is the Human Resource Committee, which will be made up of several ministers and so on, who will review the recommendations from the CPO. And they will see, after liaising with their counterparts and so on, so the Minister of Finance and so on, this is how much an increase of this kind will cost the country. And that body would have to report and say, well, this is what we can offer. That's too high. It will affect the economy. It will do this, that, and the other. And the CPO just comes back to the union and says, well, this is what the government says it can offer. So the CPO is a middleman liaising between the government and the unions. The unions, of course, will have their position. So whether they want to see an increase in the cost of living allowance, whether they would want to see a uniform allowance involved in their negotiations, as part of their offerings, their benefits, and so on. So it's a process that usually, because of the climate of Trinidad and Tobago, you would tend to see a lot of the matters going to the industrial court because talks have broken down between the CPO and the unions and so on. So,
sorry to interrupt, but with the idea that now the CPOs, the positioning of the latest I don't want to use the word confrontation, but discussion between the port workers, it says that what the CPO presented is null and void because it's not. So it's very confusing, the role of the CPO. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm glad that you're giving some definition to it. But at the same time, with that example, it seems that they have no power at all.
Well, in some sense, you can say that it is an administrative function to a very large extent. So it's like the government's research center for things relative to negotiations, labor issues, and so on, especially when it comes to determining your benefits, when it comes to salary increases, when it comes to the things that are attached to your office or the office you hold. And so you have the CPO that deals with a lot of those other wage negotiations, but the SRC is looking at the government and the public officials that fall under its remit. So more or less, it is provided for in our legislation that the SRC will deal with salaries for these positions, whereas the CPO, once there is a unionized unit or workforce or what have you, they will be engaging with the CPO in this process. And what I want to say to all of this really is that if we as a country are dissatisfied with that process or the process that we currently implement, then let's start working toward other solutions. I hate the idea that TNTech workers have to wait several years over different bargaining periods. To go through that negotiation only to be told that they're getting 4% or whatnot for this period, which should have taken place whether 10 years ago or however long. We need to update our wage negotiations. We need to get to a point where every negotiation has been settled so we can start looking forward toward paying people their correct salary. So this idea of back pay and all of that, and while it may seem nice to some people and nicer to other people that, you know, you're able to collect a 20,000 or a 30,000 or how much ever it is from back pay, it's a clear fact that if you had been making that salary, the adjusted salary, all along, that means you would have had more money to go to the grocery, more
to
funds
save
available to you to take care of your family, to save, to do all of these things. So it might seem nice that you will collect this lump sum, but you have to wait several years in order to collect
it.
Could have gone toward paying your mortgage, paying this, paying that, and so on. So we have to be realistic about what we're asking, and we have to be solution-oriented. It shouldn't be about bacchanal and confusion and which union banging the table and the desk the hardest and all of that. This is barbaric. It's adversarial. This is not who we should be as a people in 2024 going into 2025. So I'm hoping that the tempers will cool down a bit and people will actually take the time to recognize that this is far less about politics and far more about giving people what they deserve. Of course, it's going to have a financial implication, but that's what happens when you try to manage an economy such as ours. You have competing interests. You want to build a community center or pave a road or extend the highway, whatever it is. You have to balance that against the various needs that people have on a daily basis. And the question one may ask is if the government is doing enough when it comes to that. And I think every citizen has to really sit down and ask themselves if this is the right approach. We know the Forex issue is one of those hot topics right now. When you're hearing different positions from various economists versus the minister, they're saying float the dollar, devalue it, all of this. The Ministry of Finance is saying that that's not in the best interest of the country. So we just really need to listen, we need to become solution oriented, and I hope that we'll be willing to support the academics, the advocates, the people who are out there doing the work to provide the information. We need to be able to support them to get that information to the desks of the various MPs, to the desks of the Prime Minister, and all those leaders in our country. And we need to remove the emotion and the politics from it. That's the only way that we're going to really build a society into one that we can be proud of. Right now, it's maybe about patriotism because, you know, you're born here and this is our Trinidad and Tobago. But I think to really achieve true patriotism in this country, we need to see the wheels of justice training and democracy. We need to feel a part of our society that our voices matter and that it's far less about bacchanal and confusion and more about nation building. That's really my hope for all of these discussions and the tempers that are flaring, that we will come back to our place, that it should be Trinidad and Tobago first and the needs of the people.
Well, we have some callers calling in. Let's take a call and see what comments we have so far. Hello, good morning.
Sure.
Good morning, Ms. Tosca, and your guest there. I'm calling from Arima.
Good morning. This good is morning. Mr. Nikolai Edwards with us. Yeah. So good morning to you, Arima.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, good morning.
Now, morning, morning.
I have been a public servant for 42 years. I was a career public servant. And you know, you would hear my beginning salary really at first in the 70s, in 1970, I think it was $213. And we got a 5%. It went to 290. Anyway, that is behind it. But every time you see a negotiation coming for the public service, you hear things about market value. They're doing many times they negotiate, they're going to do a study on the market value comparative in the private sector and whatnot. And it's just rhetoric because they never. All you get, a little percentage increase, right? You get a percentage increase and all talk about market. Well, this day, you hear about the SRC and whatsoever it is. They have their ways of doing things, and they will study comparative market value and whatnot. And, you know, politicians being holding positions peculiar to other areas, you know, that is expected. But what I'm saying, public servants, and then you hear to say public servants lazy, public, you know, the broad brushing. Right? No, they are hardworking public. What about the hardworking public servants? Yes, they may have some lackadaisical or whatnot. But and so that is my point. Every time you hear is market value, they're doing with a survey and whatnot, but nothing ever comes out of it. And I also want to talk about the local government. Before the local government election, they talk about the local government practitioners, and these are people who are overlooked. Because you wouldn't believe, I have a relative that is in that group. And all hours in the night, people call them to come and look at a drain and one set of problems. They do work hard. And you know what happened? Local government reform was expected to address this and was just before the election and was just rhetoric. I thank you very much. I listen over here.
Thank you so much for your call, your comments on that.
Yeah, well, especially that last part, it's very telling. It's so true that there was all this talk about local government and so on. And here we are closing out yet another year, 2024. And we've not seen the implementation of that local government legislation being fully proclaimed. And that's the point where I can understand people's frustration with politicians. Mm-hmm. You had the People's National Movement, and I'm not trying to make it into a PNM thing versus UNC thing, but I'm just calling the facts as I see it. You had in 2019, the government mounting a serious campaign about if you were to vote for them, they would seek out local government reform. They would pass the legislation and so on. But I keep saying to people that when you vote in a local government election, it has absolutely no implications or direct implications on legislation in parliament.
Essential
because
government,
the government
yes.
of the day. Central government is already in place. We already have the government with a majority, and it is the government's responsibility to pass the legislation, our members of parliament and our senators. So We saw the results of that election, and we found ourselves in more or less a same place in Inertia. Now, of course, one would see that the Ministry of Local Government is doing the work behind the scenes and so on. But why didn't they say that to the public, that this is going to take 3, 4, 5 years for implementation? No, instead you were told, you were baited to come and vote and so on.
It sounds good. It's all flashy. You know, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. And then nothing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with the first part of the caller's thing where he would have mentioned that the research is done, market value, and nothing comes out of it, that's incorrect to say that nothing comes out of it. As you would have mentioned earlier, that the CPO to some degree seems powerless or just really the middleman, as we see. But genuine research is done, because we are pumping money into the education of our society through GATE. We have all of these statisticians, we have researchers, all of these people coming out of university, and I am very confident in their ability and the kind of quality work that they would produce. The issue is when the academics ends or the administrative part ends and the politics begins, that's where the issue is. So in as much as there may be this very detailed report and proper recommendations being given to the government about what the salaries should be adjusted to, the wages should be adjusted to, the politics comes into play where that committee that I mentioned, the HR committee of the government, they have competing interests. So they may want to build, let's say, a new stadium, or do a highway extension, or buy another fast ferry, all right? Those things cost money. And so they know the benefit that this is going to have, not just for the people of Trinidad and Tobago, but also to their image. So they would much rather put money towards certain projects that will have a higher benefit to them than if we have to go and settle these negotiations.
But the thing is, you would still need the workers to get to the site to build the overpass or whatever it is that you mentioned there just now as the project that will make them quote unquote look good. They will still have to, the workers still have to buy lunch, still have to find transport. So it's a bit still annoying to those listening about these salary increases to think that the government or the government of the day, because you know you have to state that you don't want it to be made into a political football. The government of the day should pay more attention to the human resource of actually that workforce that gets those projects that you so want done, and make the time or take the period to really settle these wage negotiations across the board from the top official all the way down to the public servant. They still have to survive.
A very famous individual once said, "You raise the price of gas," and they hadn't rioted as yet. And I think that is what is at play here. The kind of riots or the protests that you would see from many of these unions, they don't have the kind of impact that you would expect coming into it. So the port workers and so on, of course, by holding up the port, you are holding up people's Christmas gifts and stores or businesses receiving their goods and so on. But it has to work in such a way where the pressure is being felt from the wider public as to you need to fix this issue. So in the case of teachers, for instance, where are the parents coming to the fore and saying that, yes, my son's teacher deserves an increase or a salary in line with the kind of hard work that he or she puts out in educating my child? So it has to be a greater collective effort if we want to see things move into this country, because I'm quite sure that the government, whichever government that is in office, when the unions come up and stuff, they say, well, that's just a regular thing, and they pay it no mind.
Pay it no mind. And this is another conversation that a lot of interest groups and those who engage in these type of discussions are, to me, seem to be afraid to address. Because the idea of actually having some sort of action, protest action, bear the results in favor of those who are protesting, I don't that used to happen a long time. I don't see it happening now, because I don't want to say the gumption is gone, but the way in which that type of action is executed now, it's almost like a show, and no, and they don't expect any kind of real movement after that. So probably we could have a conversation on that separately, because it's it's almost like I feel like if it's a I don't want to say a threat, but it's almost like if y'all think you're going to get through with that kind of it now working here tonight, basically.
It's like a child. Exactly. It's like a child in Goshi with his mother. You are walking through the aisles and stuff, and the child is performing and trained on himself.
Putting on a trauma.
And doing all this. And it might be embarrassing to the mother and so on. And it's like one of those things that you kind of expect as the routine, unless you train your child properly or you have certain things in place. And even you can incentivize your child to do the right thing. There's different styles of parenting, much as the same way there are different styles of governance and leadership. And we have to choose the right leadership to lead us as a society. I think that we have and have had the kind of leadership that the society deserves, because of course it's the majority of persons who are deciding to vote and who are placing these individuals in the various offices to allow them to do and make the decision. We have to start internally reflecting on what are we willing to do to go out there and get the kind of leadership that this country deserves. Otherwise, we get what we take what we get, because we have not engaged properly in the process. And the idea of voting doesn't make sense to certain the other, it does. And especially for the people who go out there and vote and they get the result that they want, it's further confidence, further validation as to why to them voting matters.
And finally, as we're at 10 o'clock, but I could take a little 5-10 minutes just to close off, sure. You know, what can we learn from this process? Speaking about the positioning of the CPO, speaking about the positioning of the SRC, the process of how they came about this report, what are some of the things you want the public to understand, to take away from that process?
So what I want people to take away first and foremost is that it is, in fact, a process. It's not that the Minister of Finance or the Prime Minister or the President woke up one morning and decided, let's raise the salaries. That's not what it is. It's a constitutional mandate that the SRC has to review salaries in this country. Despite it being such a difficult subject and so on, they have that mandate. The president has to sign off on the SRC doing a review. So there is that process in place. We have to either respect the process or challenge the process. Let's not try to simply challenge the individuals, because they, so whether we're seeing the members of the commission right now or the ministers who sit in parliament right now, it's not about just them. We have to think broader. We have to think more long term. Do we want to completely do away with this process in place for some other process? Because it can't be that we simply strip them of their powers, have nothing else in place, and hope that the society functions. In order for society to function, we have to have certain systems and mechanisms in place. And this is but one system or mechanism in place that is meant to treat with wages in this country. So on a broader level, I want people to open their eyes and their ears. Don't just take what the person that you're sitting down in a taxi listening to, who is saying as they're listening to the radio, you see them politicians and them, all they're doing is teething this, that, and the other. That might not be the best person to get the information from. What you would want to do is research. Go up online. Yes, you can listen and you hear people's feedbacks and feedback and stuff, but don't adopt other people's positions just because it's the loudest position in the room or the loudest voice in the room. You really have to drill down into it. And I believe in this SRC process as it stands right now. Of course, there are things that can be strengthened, and one of that being more timely reports when it comes to various offices and so on. But for the most part, I think that we have good systems in place. What we may not have is good people in place. And if you want to treat with that, I've already said that there is a process to do with that, elections and so on. As it relates to this, my position, as I started off, I am very firm that the report should be adopted. And if it's not adopted, let's say this year, I think that the government has a responsibility and a duty to outline when it can be adopted, because people's salaries have to raise. They have to be in line with the market and so on, because we need to do away with the idea of you're going to the grocery and you could only get a handful of items for $100. That's the reality that citizens face in this country. So we need to improve the buying power of our citizens. It's not going to be a case where we're going to see prices go down. We need to see salaries come up.
Right?
Nowhere. I can't imagine anywhere where you're seeing the prices of food and so on just going down. Unless we become dependent, self-dependent or independent, where we can grow our own food, we can do a lot more manufacturing and so on. We are expecting the price shocks that comes with buying from the market. So if you want to change that, if you want to change the buying power that you have, maybe it's time that we really drill down into a process of determining what is the best way forward. But grumbling, complaining, denying a prime minister his rightful salary or a president a rightful salary is not going to improve your situation in any which way. So we need to be more practical about how we approach it.
Mr. Edwards, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I know limited time, but we will have some discussions again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.